Thank you. So again, as with the previous talk, apologies to those of you who already know everything that I'm going to say. But again, my role here is to provide a very basic overview of some of the biology which will underlie some of the both acute effects and carcinogenesis, which you'll hear about in some of the subsequent talks. And so my goal here is also not to be exhaustive, but just to give you sort of an overview and a bit of a feel for some of the basic processes which take place on the cellular and molecular level in response to radiation. And so I'll touch initially on just damage to cells, emphasis on DNA damage as being very important in this context. Then we'll move on to talk about some of the effects of this radiation damage, touching on cell cycle arrest, DNA repair, and cell death. And then finally, I want to talk about some of the ways that we can use these basic biological processes to detect radiation damage and perhaps predict dose. Again, emphasizing one of the aspects of our center here, which David touched upon a bit at the end of his talk. And so mentioning some of the assays here that we're trying to develop for biodosimetry. So to start with, again, radiation damage. You saw in the beginning of the first talk, ionizing radiation removes electrons from matter and causes molecular bonds to break. So this can damage essentially anything within the cell. And when this happens to a cell, when it sustains radiation damage, this initiates a number of signaling cascades. So the cell can detect damage. I shouldn't trust myself to use these all-in-one things. But a lot of the signaling arises from the nucleus. We'll look more closely at DNA damage. You get a wave of signaling there. But damage to other parts of the cell can also result in signaling. For instance, damage at the cell membrane up here can also initiate some of these signaling cascades. We're not going to really focus on that now. My focus is going to be mainly on events that start centered on DNA damage and arise from the nucleus. But just to let you know, there's a lot of other things talking to each other in the cell. So we've said we can damage any part of the cell. Why are we so concerned about DNA? Well, if you damage one of your organelles, you get a bad mitochondria. You can make more. If you damage a protein, if radiation... Okay, I'm going to use the other laser pointer here for safety. So if we damage a protein here, we can make more of them. The cell knows how to do that. But if you damage your DNA, you're in much more trouble. You can't go back and just get more DNA. So this is why you have a number of systems designed specifically to protect the integrity of the DNA in the cell. And this is very critical. Everything else kind of flows from the DNA. So what kind of damage do we get in DNA? From ionizing radiation, we can get a number of different types of damages. If you recall from basic biology, the DNA strand consists of this phosphate sugar backbone, and then it has various bases attached to this backbone, and you get your double strand of DNA by having base pairing between another strand, which isn't shown here, between these bases. But so the bases themselves can be damaged by ionizing radiation. And we show over here just a number of the specific types of base damage which can be caused by radiation. These tend to be not a really major concern because for most of these specific lesions, there are specific enzymes which can remove them from the DNA, reverse the lesions fairly efficiently. You can get an abasic site where you actually lose the base. But again, this can be relatively effectively repaired. But you can also damage the sugar phosphate backbone here. And this is now the type of damage that we're going to focus on in terms of radiation damage, these so-called strand breaks, when you damage the actual backbone of the DNA, are generally the most important. And again, here we see our actual double helix, where we have two strands. You can have a single strand break which only damages one of these strands. You can also have either a double strand break which cuts straight through, or you can have two single strand breaks that are very close together so that if the strand is resected a little bit, it effectively becomes, from two single breaks, a double strand break. And these are the lesions which we are most concerned of. These are thought to be the major lesions which are responsible for most of the cell killing after ionizing radiation exposure. So this is, again, where it's a lot of diversity, but we're focusing down now on the double-strand breaks themselves. So cells have a number of mechanisms by which they can detect these double-strand breaks because they are very important to the cell. It wants to know when it has a break, and it wants to do something about it. So, we see here just kind of sitting, waiting, bound to the DNA, our H2AX, which came in at the end of the previous talk, and I'll say more about that also in terms of biodosimetry towards the end of my talk. But what can happen here is we get this MRN complex, which comes in and identifies the broken ends. This then recruits ATM protein, the protein that's mutated in ataxia telangiectasia. We'll come back to this several times. This is a very important protein, ATM, very central in signal transduction from radiation damage. Certainly not the only protein that's involved, but this is one of the major pathways that I want to emphasize here. And again, as I go through all of this, I keep saying, you know, we tend to look at sort of an example pathway, some of the major stuff. There's a lot of other signaling going on. We always want to keep that in the back of our minds here. But when the ATM is recruited to this site of strand break and activated by phosphorylation, it can then also phosphorylate the H2AX protein, which is bound to the DNA and making up part of its normal structure. And this is, I'm just showing one molecule here, but this will be kind of a chain reaction. You'll get a patch of phosphorylated H2AX. And this comes back to what David Brenner was mentioning in his talk, where you can actually detect phosphorylation. And this is why it's correlated with strand breaks. You can sort of see a strand break in the cell by detecting these phosphorylated proteins. And again, a little bit more of that towards the end of my talk. There are other mechanisms for recognizing strand breaks also. Ku7080 protein is one that's very much involved, and recruiting DNA PK. This is another kinase molecule. Kinases phosphorylate other proteins. It's kind of a recurring theme in signal transduction within the cell. So you get these kind of cascades of proteins activating the next protein, which goes on and does, fans out from there. As, for example, again, our friend ATM, this now is way up at the top here. We see our strand break, and this is the initial complex being recruited to the site of the break, activating ATM. And what I didn't show you in the last slide, I just showed you H2AX is shown over here now. But this also acts as a kinase on a huge variety of other proteins. So again, this theme of something being activated and then talking to a lot of other systems in the cell. And here we see it being involved in changing genes that regulate transcription factors that regulate gene expression, has a lot of effects on cell cycle proteins, the BRCA protein being part of this cascade, something you may have heard of being very involved in breast cancer. The thing that I want to point out of all of this diversity is ATM, among many other things, activates P53. Again, a molecule you very well have probably heard of, tumor suppressor P53. You hear about this a lot. It's very much involved in cancer. About half of all human cancers involve this pathway. But this is the pathway through ATM, and P53 is really sort of the central response to ionizing radiation. There's an awful lot of other things that respond, but this is kind of the classic radiation response pathway. And so, again, this is what I'm going to focus on. And here, P53 just being shown affecting, this is a transcription factor shown affecting transcription of just a couple of genes in this screen. But again, as I think we're already picking up, the theme is everything is much more complex than it seems at first glance. And so again, here's P53 being activated by radiation among other stresses. For each stress, it has a little bit different response or pattern of effector genes, so the genes that actually carry out the work. We're looking at just some of them here. It's a list of some of the prominent P53-regulated genes. And these have roles in diverse pathways. We're going to look a little bit more closely at cell cycle response and at apoptosis. Some DNA repair genes also involved, but we're not really going to look at the P53 repair pathway. So we'll focus on cell cycle and apoptosis here. And so this is the mammalian cell cycle, and this becomes important in a lot of the tissues that are very susceptible to radiation damage, such as the blood-forming tissues. Your blood cells turn over fairly rapidly. You're continually making new cells from your stem cells. Also, the cells of the intestinal tract are continually renewing. So this cycle of cell cycle division is very important to a lot of these organ systems. And again, you'll be hearing more about those in the acute effects talk, but this is kind of some of the basic biology underlying that. And so you have a number of proteins which drive the cell around this cell cycle. There are cyclins, which are made and expressed cyclically, as you might guess from their name, that sort of tell the cell which part of the cell cycle it's supposed to be in. So the various cyclins will be specific for G1 or S, showing the cell kind of where it is. And then these interact with cyclin-dependent kinases, so our old friends kinases, again, that are going to go on phosphorylate other proteins. But those are made active based on which cyclin partners they're coupled with and to propel the cell around the cell cycle. So that's just kind of the very basic, very general view of how the cell kind of uses different proteins to know where it is and push itself through all the steps it needs to do to divide. So it needs to make new DNA so it can have two copies of all its chromosomes, and then it needs to separate those into daughter cells and keep doing this. And so radiation affects this process, as we might guess. If there's damage to the cell, it really doesn't want to keep pushing itself through this cycle because that can lead to catastrophic death. And so there are a number of mechanisms which allow the cell to halt its division after it's been irradiated. And so we refer to these as cell cycle checkpoints, and the major ones that occur in response to irradiation exposure occur in G1 and G2. And so, again, as just an example, we're going to look principally at the G1 cell cycle arrest. Because this is a very nice example of our ATM P53 pathway. So again, we saw our DNA damage activating the ATM protein, which in turn activates P53, among many other things. P53 itself does many, many things. One of the genes that it upregulates very prominently is CDKN1A, which is, I think, among many of us, better known as the P21 protein, CYP1, WAF1. Unfortunately, a lot of these proteins and genes have many names. But this protein, whatever name it's known by, binds to the G1 cyclin CDK complexes that are present in the cell and essentially inhibits the kinase activity. So that shuts the cell down in G1. It doesn't allow it to progress on, do the things it needs to do to keep moving further in the cell cycle. And this arrest in response to radiation can either be transient or permanent. And I want to show you one of the ways that you can look at this cell cycle arrest is through flow cytometry. For anyone who's not familiar with this, this is a way of measuring, looking at cells. This axis shows you cell number. This axis gives you relative amount of DNA in the cell. So a cell that hasn't started dividing will have just its normal complement of DNA, and you see a sharp peak here in G1. Then as the cell enters S phase, it starts replicating its DNA. So you're getting progressively more and more DNA content, and the cell starts to move across here until it gets double the normal complement. It's replicated everything, and you see a G2 peak where you have essentially two copies of all your chromosomes. The cell is ready to divide. After mitosis, it'll be two cells instead of one, and those two cells will be back here. So that's just a normal, happily dividing cell. What happens when you irradiate a normal wild-type cell is all this P53 activates, so on and so forth, and you see G1 arrest reflected here. You get your G1 peak. You've lost pretty much everything in S phase. Nothing new is going into S and starting this process. The things that started out in S have generally completed. They flow through the S phase compartment, and they pile up in G2. So you have those two cell cycle blocks that hold the cell, prevent it from going into mitosis with DNA damage. And the general thought is that this allows the cell a chance to execute DNA repair, fix any damage it might have, and then when everything's good again, it can continue on through the cell cycle. And again, in the transient form, this is generally what we see. The cells will arrest for a while, then they'll move on. One of the ways that we know that P53 and P21 are very much involved in this process is by being able to make knockouts either of cells or of knockout mice where you can remove this gene. And either in the case of either P53 or P21, so if we lose either one of these genes, don't have that protein anymore, normally the cells look just fine. They keep going through the cell cycle, no problem. But when you irradiate them, you no longer have this G1 arrest. There's just no G1 cells, and this is because the cells that started out there don't have that block. They just keep going. They go straight through S, and then they hit the G2. So there's a redundancy here. You do have this second measure, second checkpoint is still generally active in the absence of P53. But you can very clearly see that, you know, losing P53, you've lost kind of half of your cell cycle checkpoint control here. So, again, a common theme in biology is backup systems and redundancy, and we see an example of this here. So, again, what's the advantage to the cell of not dividing for a while and then deciding everything's okay again and continuing the cycle? Well, while the cell is arrested, as I said, the general thought is this allows an opportunity to repair the damaged DNA. So you've gone through this phase of, you've had proteins that detect a break and they say, okay, stop everything, we have damage. They recruit in all these proteins, then what happens? So here we see two major pathways of strand break repair. The first one can only operate, homologous recombination can only operate when you have the second replicated copy of your DNA. So in this case, it's a very accurate form of repair because you have another copy. If you have missing information in the middle of the break, you've got another copy of it here. And so there's a complex of proteins that can come in and essentially use the information on the other strand to fill in what's missing, make sure everything's lined up correctly. And this is very efficient, but unfortunately, yeast do this really well. This is not, you don't get this process happening quite as efficiently in human cells. Mammalian cells more commonly use the other method, which is non-homologous end joining. One advantage here is you don't need the other strands. You can do it at any part of the cell cycle. But the disadvantage is if you've had resection away from the site of a break, so there's a gap like you can see here, the cell doesn't see there's a gap. It sees two ends and it sticks them together. Similarly, as we'll see in some of the subsequent slides, you don't even necessarily have the right two pieces of DNA, the right two strands. If you've got more than one break in the cell, you might get stuck to the wrong chromosome when you repair this. But this is actually the major pathway of double-strand break repair in mammalian cells. So what's the result of this? What happens if you misrepair your cell or your damage? And this easy answer is you get mutations. This is where mutations come from. Radiation, ionizing radiation, can actually increase pretty much all classes of mutation. We see a little chart over here showing both spontaneous mutation levels and the numbers of different types of mutations in response to, in this case, a two gray dose of gamma radiation. So you get a slight increase in the point mutations, so that would be very, very small changes that just involve one or two base pairs in the DNA. And as these, and then deletions, as these get progressively larger, they're more and more affected by ionizing radiation exposure. Really big deletions don't happen spontaneously very often, but they are very much enhanced by radiation. And over on this side, the cartoon is just showing sort of a mapping scheme where you have a selectable marker, so you know that gene's mutated in the cells you select, and then you can map and see how many nearby markers are involved. And you get these patterns of how big the deletions are, where they occur. And this, I'm not really going to say much more about mutation. This is just kind of a little lead-in, again, for some of the subsequent talks. This is one of the pathways which will underlie some of the late effects, such as carcinogenesis, or if it occurs in germ cells, some of the hereditary effects that I think we'll hear a little about this afternoon. So getting back to incorrect repair in a little more detail, a lot of this type of misrepair can be detected cytogenetically. And in this case, we see two breaks that occur in separate chromatids. And if they just join back up where they're supposed to, that's fine. But you can get them exchanging between the, as I said, you can join back to the wrong chromosome. And there are two different ways that this can happen. If you get the distal part joining to the proximal part here and these kind of switch off, you get something like this. So you just kind of have the wrong end stuck to the chromosome. And when it goes through mitosis, you can visualize these things, and you've just got the wrong part. This is a translocation, generally not lethal, but we'll show one example where this type of event can actually activate an oncogene. So just because it's not necessarily lethal to the cell, it can still have consequences. The other way that these things can rejoin is the two distal parts can join, and the two parts with the centromere, the little white dot here is the centromere, which is necessary for separating the chromosomes during mitosis. If they adjoin this way, you get what turns into a dicentric when you come to mitosis. You've got two centromeres in one chromosome. This forms an acentric fragment, which will just be lost during mitosis. These dicentrics can cause really big problems when the cell tries to divide. You can get bad spindle formation. The cell's kind of pulling in two different directions when it tries to separate these things into the daughter cells. And so very often, these dicentrics are usually lethal. And now, as I said, I just wanted to briefly touch on one example of a translocation that can have consequences. This is in CML, chronic myeloid leukemia. The classic translocation, which is seen very frequently in this disease, is between chromosome 9 and 22, where you have on chromosome 9 the c-Abl proto-oncogene, and there's a very frequent breakpoint shown by this dashed white line here, and another breakpoint which occurs just beyond the BCR locus in chromosome 22, resulting in this abnormal chromosome 9, which is not so much of a problem, but also fusing up the BCR with the c-Abl proto-oncogene, leading to an activated oncogene, what's called the Philadelphia chromosome, you may have heard of. And this definitely has a role in disease etiology. So there are times when a translocation can be a very bad thing for a cell. And that's just one kind of classic example that's known. So getting down to this a little bit more, in a little more detail, how do we really see these things? How can we watch what's happening? How do we really know these changes are taking place? Well, it used to be a lot more difficult with classical cytogenetics. You just had kind of black and white images, which always looked a bit fuzzy to me. You had to be a real expert to be able to tell these little fine banding patterns and what belonged to what chromosome if a little piece was in the wrong place. But we have very sophisticated means of doing this now, which make these translocations much easier to see. And multiplex FISH or MFISH is one approach to this. There's also SCI is a similar technique, where you have a combination of different colored probes. So you can have a probe combination to each specific chromosome, which has a unique combination of each of these colored dyes in the probes that hybridize to that chromosome, so that when you put them all together, each chromosome will be painted, essentially, with its own particular color, and you can distinguish these on the computer, and even someone like me can very easily tell which chromosome is which. And so we can use this to illustrate some of these simple aberrations. And this here is shown. This is I was a little confused by this cartoon. This is actually the way it's folded over. It looks like the two chromatids, but this is actually one chromosome with one arm and its centromere in the other. And so it's showing a simple break in two separate chromosomes. They rejoin incorrectly, so we get a simple translocation, and we can see this very easily, at least if the lights are low enough, where these white arrows are. We've got a purple and a pale blue fused together. Both of these are reciprocal. Both the chromosomes look the same. Very easy to pick up a translocation when they're painted nicely for you like this. And we can also get even fancier with this technique. Instead of looking at all the chromosomes, we can look in much more detail at a single chromosome by using the same type of painting, except to create bands along the length of a single chromosome. So this allows you to pick up events which occur within a single chromosome. So in this case, again, we have one chromosome folded over, and there's a break either side of the centromere. You've got the two arms misjoined, and you see this in the banding pattern of the chromosome. The centromere is pointed out by this white arrow here, and it essentially is equivalent to having that middle section of the chromosome flipped around the centromere. And so this is called a paracentric inversion. And you can also have a paracentric inversion where you have a break that two breaks that occur on the same arm of a single chromosome, and if this break flips around and gets repaired the wrong way around. Again, here you see the centromere pointed out by the arrow and this kind of flipping of the segment on one arm of the chromosome in this case, and that's a paracentric inversion. And these things are very difficult to score without this type of fancy banding pattern. And I really want to point this out because this has been, David Brenner didn't mention this, but this is one of the few means of distinguishing between high LET and low LET exposure that a person has received. Very specifically, you can see these types of changes when a person's been exposed to high LET, or like the alpha particles, as opposed to low LET, where you don't see these events. So that's been kind of one of the few cytogenetic markers that's been specific for the type of radiation. I won't really say any more about that. That's not really the major focus of our center. But I think it is sort of interesting that we're starting to find some ways of even distinguishing the type of radiation a person has seen. So now moving on to cell killing. I show this sort of complex diagram here to really emphasize that when you're thinking of radiation damage and cell killing, you really, really need to be looking at clonogenic survival. And so this is not a short-term assay. There's a number of short-term assays which are very, very useful for many chemical exposures where cell death occurs very rapidly. Within 2 or 3 days, you can use some of these exclusion dyes like trypan blue exclusion or MTT. People do apply this to radiation, but you really get much more accurate measures of radiation killing by doing it the old-fashioned way, the long, hard way, plating out various numbers of cells on individual dishes, irradiating them, waiting a couple weeks for them to grow, and counting up colonies. And so I think this is sort of important to emphasize. You really need to look at colony formation to get a full idea of radiation killing. It doesn't all happen to the cell immediately. And again, some of this is to do with the cell cycle delay. You know, the cells can try to cope with that damage, and you don't know for a while if they've done it successfully or not. And so then this sort of data is collected and plotted in survival curves, which I want to show partly just to emphasize, again, a theme which keeps coming up is this dose responsiveness. So as our dose increases here, we get more and more cell killing, and this can actually be fit to a line. I won't go into all these parameters other than to say, point out the difference between these two lines here. This one has what we call a shoulder. It has kind of a more gradual initial slope, and then at a certain point, that gradual slope stops, and we get a linear response as the dose continues to increase. For some cell lines or with the densely ionizing radiation, you don't see that. You just get an immediate straight slope, straight decrease with dose. And the difference which seems to drive this difference in the shape of the survival curve, this is marked here, densely ionizing radiation, but also repair deficient cells. So if you knock out some of these repair proteins which we've seen, like the DNA PK or the Ku, the cells sort of lack this initial repair response, which is reflected by the gradual slope at the top of the curve here, and they just plunge straight down. So loss of ability to repair, or these densely ionizing radiations, which generally produce lesions which are more difficult for the cell to repair. They tend to be more complex, more clustered, harder to repair. You get this sort of response. And before we leave these survival curves, the other thing that I want to point out is that a radiation dose is not always exactly the same as a radiation dose. It always also depends on how long it takes you to get it. And I'm illustrating this just with survival, but this applies to many of these other parameters also, such as mutation or gene expression. What we're showing here is an acute exposure. The exposure happens all at once very rapidly. As we slow that exposure down and take longer and longer for the cell to accumulate the same total dose, we get a protection. We see less and less cell killing the more slowly the dose is delivered. And I really want to emphasize this because that is a very important point, and both in terms of these biological endpoints, also in terms of the effect on the individual. And also, if you think back to some of those scenarios that David Brenner was showing, where, you know, okay, that you had those rings around the stadium where you got 25 centigrade or something, but that was if you sat there for 24 hours. So there is always this time component, which it really is important to keep that in mind when you're thinking about the effects of radiation. So a little more specifically now, instead of just looking at these curves, how do cells die after they've been exposed to radiation? Maybe they've tried to repair their damage and haven't been able to do it. Well, then what? One of the prominent ways that cells die is apoptosis. This is a genetic program, very, very tightly regulated way for the cell to essentially commit suicide, also referred to as programmed cell death. This is a very prominent response in a lot of the rapidly dividing cells, so blood cells, cells in the gut will tend to undergo apoptosis in response to ionizing radiation when they die. Other cells don't apoptose quite as readily. Maybe a fibroblast, for instance, is more likely to undergo necrosis if it dies from radiation. And this is a distinct process. It also has kind of its own steps, but they are not quite the same as apoptosis. So you rapidly lose ATP during necrosis. The cell membrane breaks down. It's associated with local inflammation, shrinkage of the nuclei. The DNA does degrade, but in the case of necrosis, it's a random degradation. As we'll see in a moment, apoptosis has a very precise breakdown of the DNA, which is often associated with it. Cells can also die through mitotic catastrophe. This is a little more vague designation, I think, at this point. But essentially, it's thought to occur when the cell attempts to go through mitosis with too much damage, getting conflicting signals, perhaps. Sometimes the cell is being told to divide and told to arrest at the same time. So you can have this kind of catastrophic meltdown during an attempted mitosis also. So looking just a little more closely at apoptosis, some of the prominent hallmarks which define this method of cell death include chromatin condensation, which you can see up here in some of these cells, where the nuclei kind of break down. You get these really brightly staining globules almost in the nuclei. The cell membrane also undergoes very distinct changes. Phosphatidylserine, which is one of the membrane lipids, translocates actually from the inner part of the cell membrane to the outer part. You see a loss of mitochondrial membrane potential. Other changes take place within the mitochondria. Caspases are activated. These are very specific proteases, which then start breaking down some of the proteins in the cell. And you also, as I mentioned, see, not always, but often, you see this typical DNA laddering, which is illustrated here, where you get cleavage in between the nucleosomes. So part of the whole DNA structure is cleaved between the nucleosome structures. And you can get these very clear ladders. So that's kind of on the cellular level, some of what happens during apoptosis. Again, how do we get there? How do we drive that process? Well, as with so much in biology, there's more than one method to generate apoptosis. The pathway I want to just touch on briefly involves our friend P53 again when it becomes activated. And if you recall back to that chart that I showed you, one of the major, next to cell cycle, one of the major processes that P53 genes are involved in regulating is, in fact, apoptosis. And curiously, activated P53 will stimulate production of both pro-apoptotic genes and anti-apoptotic genes. So again, there's always this balance, whether the cell is going to tilt towards life or death, apoptosis or arrest. Not to show all the factors thought to play into this, but certainly cell type is some of this, just depending on the environment of the cell, some of the external signals coming into the cell, what cell type is, will help determine how this balance is driven, whether the cell apoptoses or not. So again, nothing is straightforward or simple. But the pro-apoptotic signals here will, among these are BACs, many others. One of the major functions is to act on the mitochondria. One of many things which happens in the mitochondria in this process is release of cytochrome C. This then goes on and interacts with the APAF1 gene product. Again, another gene which is activated by P53. Keeps getting its fingers into everything. And this then forms what's known as an aptosome, which can activate procaspases. So here we have caspase 9. This is present as in an inactive proform of the protein in the cell. When this cascade starts initiating, the aptosome will cleave off part of the protein, giving us activated caspase 9. This, in turn, will activate caspase 3, which is an effector caspase, and this then can go off and start cleaving specific proteins in the cell. So this is just kind of one slice, one method that the cell can initiate apoptosis. Another prominent pathway of apoptosis is through death receptors on the cell membrane. And these processes, of course, talk to each other. If you lose P53, the cell can still apoptose. Generally, it's delayed. You don't see the initial wave of apoptosis as soon as you would. But again, this whole theme of redundancy in the cell takes a little longer. But in this case, even without P53, the cell can use another mechanism and undergo apoptosis. So we've kind of had a whirlwind tour through many aspects of biology, and now the last bit of the talk, I want to come to, well, how can we really harness this and make it work for us in the context of biodosimetry? So I've touched on that many of these processes, the more dose, the more effect, so we can use that to try to predict exposure dose. David has gone over the need for radiological triage and biodosimetry. And again, I will just touch on a couple of the methods here that we're developing to try to establish new methods for biodosimetry. So the cytogenetics assays, which were mentioned, you've seen the formation of these dicentrics, and they increase with increasing exposure dose. So that's sort of the first thing that we need to be able to use a marker like this. And the dicentrics are actually the current gold standard for biodosimetry after radiation. One of the wonderful things about dicentrics in this context is they are pretty much specific for radiation damage. So chemicals will not give you these. You generally see these only with radiation exposure. So it's very specific. They can be detected stably for about 6 months after exposure. They're informative across a good dose range for triage from about 0.2 to maybe 5 gray. And they have already been used for biodosimetry in a lot of the prominent accidents, Chernobyl, Goiânia, which you heard about, and many others. So there's a long track record with those. Another cytogenetic method, which has been mentioned already in the first talk, is detection of micronuclei. This is a little bit simpler assay than the dicentrics and has a really much better potential for being automated. So that's why our group, this is one of the focus points of our group as far as developing high throughput techniques. And again, they're stable for about 6 months, informative over a similar dose range. And there are also international standards in place for scoring these things. And this is just showing a couple examples of a micronucleus here or in a binucleated cell. There's also these cytoplasmic bridges, which I don't know if you can see there. You can maybe almost see it here. So there are a number of these structures which can be scored for biodosimetry. There's also a premature chromatid condensation. This is informative or can be informative over actually a wider dose range. Again, with a potential for automation, there have been efforts to at least partially automate this assay, not in our group, but in others. The reason you can sometimes get to higher doses is because you can do this assay without requiring cell division. That's kind of why you have that upper bound for the 5 gray of some of these other assays, because the cell has to divide before you can score it. And that really kind of limits you. Most of these are going to be scored in peripheral blood. It's a very sensitive tissue. It's hard to stimulate those cells to divide in culture if they've had more than about a 5 gray dose of radiation. So that's a little advantage here. But when they do it without cell division, they have to fuse the cells with mitotic cells to force the chromatin to condense so that you can then detect breaks as fragments like this one that's illustrated here. It can be done without the need for cell division using chemical condensation, but again, then your upper dose is probably going to come down again because you need the cells to divide. So back to protein phosphorylation, which has already been mentioned, so I won't say too much about this. You heard that the response is very linear over a very broad dose range, which makes it very attractive for this type of assay. You don't have to make the cells divide. Again, automation potential, but then a more limited time that you can really use this assay. And we saw kind of the mechanism of activation of these H2AX foci. And down here, if you can see, with increasing dose, you get more and more green. This is an antibody that's specific for this phosphorylated form of the H2AX, and you see more and more of it with increasing dose. So my kind of personal favorite, because this is the area I work in, is trying to develop gene expression for biodosimetry. So far, this seems to be informative for doses between about 0.2 and maybe 8 gray that we've looked at. Only useful for the first couple of days after irradiation, again, as far as we've seen. We haven't really been able to look very long-term in irradiated humans because it's hard to do. But here is just a couple of genes being illustrated showing this, again, linear response at both 1 and 2 days after exposure, linear increase with increasing dose. And what makes this now a really attractive technology is we don't just have to look at the genes that we already know react to radiation. We have now this microarray technology, which allows us to screen essentially the entire genome. And it's a little washed out here, but this is actually a whole genome chip, tiny, tiny little spots on it, and blowing up a little segment, you get this dot pattern. What these dots are, for anyone who hasn't come across this yet, is you can print out probes which represent all of the genes in the genome, and then hybridize these with, in this case, a two-color approach where we have a control labeled in one color dye and an irradiated sample labeled in another color, and then the relative balance between the two colors that hybridize to any individual gene tells you relatively how much of that gene is present in which pool. So if you have the same amount, you see a yellow spot. If you have an increase after irradiation, you'll have more red, and you'll have a red spot, which I don't know if you can see it in this room. But that's kind of just the really general overview of this technique. But it's a very powerful technology, which allows us to really efficiently look for potential biomarkers with the gene expression. And so once we find them, okay, that's great, but we're not going to be running all these people into the lab and doing these big full-blown laboratory assays. So as part of this, developing this for biodosimetry, we also have collaborations with a group that's developing advanced nanofluidics, which could make these, build these tests, once we have the signature, build these into a self-contained cassette. This is an example of a cassette that actually measures DNA, a little bit different from what we're doing. This is a prototype that we're trying to develop. These result, both on the cell level and on the whole person level, in changes in metabolism. And so you get different small molecule products being excreted in pretty much any biofluid that you can sample. So urine, saliva, sweat, actually even breath. We have one project looking at exhalation and picking up these different breakdown products from cellular metabolism, which are present after irradiation. This is just showing one such product going up after radiotherapy. But we think this could be a very powerful technique. It's very early days yet, though. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, really finding the right markers and characterizing them for dose and specificity and so on. But if we manage to do that, the approach here is, okay, yeah, great, to find these things. We have this huge, fancy mass spec machine in the lab, and we get all these complicated spectra. But once we know what the molecules are that are of interest, we have current technology, which could actually very rapidly be adapted to read these signatures. So if we figure out the right small molecules to look at, we can program these into the same device. This is what they use at the airport when they occasionally swipe the handles of your bag and then they go off in the back and then they say, okay, go. What they're doing there is swiping for small molecules, putting it in this machine, which is currently programmed to detect a signature either of explosives or of drugs. But we could just as well, once we know the right molecules, program it to detect the molecules which are given off in response to radiation. So that would be the technology is already in place. If we can understand the biology enough, it would be a very, very attractive approach to biodosimetry. And so with that, I've sort of covered all the major points that I hope to cover today. And just to kind of briefly go over what I've said again, radiation damages all cellular molecules, but DNA damage is really the most critical or most concerned about. This damage to DNA initiates signaling cascades that are horribly complicated, but these result in a lot of cellular endpoints, including cell cycle arrest, DNA repair, and apoptosis or other forms of cell death. And we can use these changes that we know happen to the cells to detect radiation damage and possibly dose using some of these approaches, either cytogenetics, changes in gene expression, protein expression, or phosphorylation, or possibly even metabolic byproducts. And so that's the whirlwind tour of biology.